Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about war and peace, Russia's war against Ukraine, and the Summit on Peace in Ukraine, as it's called, that takes place in Switzerland this coming weekend. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Olga Oelicker, the Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the Crisis Group. Thanks very much for joining me, Dr. Oelicker.
Thank you for having me.
All right, it's great to have you on the show again. We'll turn to the Swiss Peace Summit a little later, but first I want to ask you about recent developments on the battlefield in Ukraine and in terms of weapons deliveries and the use of those weapons. Less than 2 weeks ago, it became clear that the United States was changing one of its key policies on the war in Ukraine, or at least adjusting it, amid increasing pressure from Kyiv and from many who support Ukraine and wanted to prevail over Russia. The Biden administration reversed course partially on what had been its refusal to allow Ukraine to use U.S.-supplied weapons against targets inside Russia. I say partially because the Biden administration is not giving Ukraine carte blanche to use American weapons against any and all targets in Russia. The green light only applies to Russian forces and facilities that are being used to attack the northeastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv and the surrounding region. And the change came after Russia stepped up air attacks on Kharkiv, which is Ukraine's second biggest city and is only about 30 kilometers from the Russian border, and also launched a cross-border offensive that opened up a new front in the Kharkiv region north of the city. Now, shortly before this U.S. shift came to light, it seemed clear that after a very alarming start to this new offensive, Russian forces were getting bogged down as Ukraine sent reinforcements, although Russian forces have made gains at the same time in the Donbass further south. Two questions here, Dr. Oelicker. How big a deal is this change in U.S. policy? And do you think it is just the first step? In other words, is the United States likely to relax these limits further and allow Ukraine to strike deeper in Russia with American-supplied weapons?
So thanks. These are good questions. The way I think about this is that Ukraine supporters have, since the start of the full-scale invasion, been gradually increasing their support to Ukraine, initially mainly in volume, but also throughout in kind. Now, there are a couple of things going on here. One is Ukrainian absorption capacity, right? If everything that eventually came to Ukraine was poured in early 2022, there is no way it could have been used. But the other piece of it is Russia's thresholds, right? You'll recall that as Russia began its full-scale invasion, it threatened consequences such as you have never imagined if anyone got in its way. And of course, Ukraine's backers judge that threat not to be credible, insofar as, you know, it was seen as a threat of nuclear war. But there was also recognition that there were things that could bring up the risk of potential nuclear escalation. And first and foremost amongst those would be a direct war between Russia and NATO member states, three of which have nuclear weapons. And of course, Russia has a vast quantity of those. So the idea was to avoid anything that made Russia think that it was really in a direct war with NATO. For all its rhetoric that says it's in a war with NATO, it too has been very careful to avoid striking NATO territory. So you've had this very gradual escalation. Now, the Russians have said very specifically that hitting Russian territory with weapons supplied by NATO member states was some kind of additional threshold. Ukraine has, of course, been striking Russian territory with indigenous weapons all this time. And then what we saw happen was allies, the British and the French saying they had absolutely no objection to Ukraine striking Russian territory with weapons they'd supplied, which is kind of a pattern we've seen where the Americans say, we're not comfortable supplying this, we're not comfortable allowing that, and then allies say, oh, we're pretty good with it, and then eventually the Americans come around. But yeah, so there's that dynamic. But the other dynamic is it has been very successful in pushing Russia's thresholds and boundaries back. So again, you know, as I said, if Western states had poured everything in at the start of the war, Ukraine couldn't have absorbed it. But also Russia would probably have felt that it was in a full-scale war, not just with Ukraine, but with NATO member states. By kind of doing all of this gradually, it makes it hard in Moscow to make that argument in any real way. So this is the latest escalation, and you don't implement the strategy without continuing to increase support. Now, the risk here, of course, is that there is a risk that at some point you do cross the a threshold. And I don't mean that you go from zero to nuclear because some system was supplied, but you do get into a world where Russia starts thinking that it is in a conflict with NATO member states. It might consider striking. I mean, Russia threatened to strike British facilities, as it put it, in Ukraine or elsewhere. So, you know, it all gets a little bit more nerve-wracking. So that's always the risk that's there. I'd say that the Americans were trying to mitigate that a little bit with this caveat, which is meant to send a message of restraint. In this particular case, it's an interesting choice of caveat because, of course, as you said, Kharkiv is not the only front line. There's a lot of speculation that the attacks in Kharkiv indeed were at least partially diversionary by Russia. So telling the Ukrainians that they can only use U.S.-provided weapons to strike in defense of Kharkiv seems a little bit odd and almost destined, right, to be shifted sooner or later. So kind of a strange place to start.
Oh, interesting. Right. And of course, it did seem to come out just as the U.S. was allowing this, you know, that the Russian offensive north of the city of Kharkiv, across the border, the cross-border offensive was kind of stuttering and still is doing so. I think Zelensky said the other day that they had essentially staved it off, although it's obviously still happening and there's still a risk. I guess I'm going to ask another question slightly related to this, the issue of the fighter jets that you know, West may be providing. And Putin said, I think in March, that Russia would reserve the right, I guess, to strike at Western jets given to Ukraine, wherever they're based, if they fly sorties over Ukraine.
Right.
And that was how I understood it. So now this appears to be happening with Ukraine saying that some of the jets will be, you know, based outside Ukraine in NATO countries. But I guess the idea is that they wouldn't be flying sorties into Ukraine from those locations, but would be there in reserve and come in and then fly, you know, take part in combat once they're already based in Ukraine. But so I'm just wondering, you know, what you think. Is this a slippery slope, or is it something that Russia's likely to again be very careful about actually going and attacking a target that's in a NATO country?
So I think you're right. I think as long as you've got them being kind of in reserve on NATO member states, but they're actually based out of Ukraine when they're flying their sorties, that's below the threshold of what Russia has voiced. Russia will, of course, also feel perfectly free to strike them if they're flying out of Ukraine, right?
Right.
But the point is that it will strike them in Ukraine. It will not be striking NATO territory. The Russians threaten the escalatory risks. They talk about the escalatory risks because they see that as a great danger too, right? So I think part of what we're seeing is a little bit of a two can play at that game response from the NATO members. So I think not in the case of the fighter jets, but just generally, where the Russians say, we can strike your territory, the NATO member states say, really, is that something you really want to do? So it's a game of chicken, which, if you've read your deterrence theory, is how you play deterrence, right? You try to make the adversary believe that you have more credibility than they do, so they are the one that backs down. Now, thus far, we haven't been in a place where anybody has had to back down because we haven't reached kind of that direct hit situation. We've had stray shells and so forth, but that's not really the same thing. If you start seeing actual targeted attacks from Russia into NATO countries or from NATO countries into Russia, that's a direct war. And again, as I said, you're not going to go zero to nuclear in 60 seconds, but that starts being the path you're possibly on in a way you're just not now.
Okay, thank you very much. Now let's talk about this upcoming meeting in Switzerland. I believe the official name is the Summit on Peace in Ukraine, and it's happening this coming weekend, June 15th and 16th, right after, or actually overlapping with the G7 summit in southern Italy on June 13th to 15th. And there's also currently a two-day reconstruction meeting going on in Berlin. So a lot of diplomacy over the Ukraine war, at least in terms of the West, Western countries. Now, I think it's safe to say that when most people hear about talks or a meeting or a summit on peace, they would assume that it involves the main sides in a war. But in this case, Russia will be absent. It was not invited and has said it wouldn't come anyway if it were. And the peace summit comes at a time when Moscow is showing no interest. I mean, there's a lot of talk about should Ukraine be urged to make peace, to hold talks. But really, Moscow seems to be showing no interest in peace or peace talks at this point, unless it's completely on Russia's terms. Putin made that clear again last week. And now China has said it won't take part in this summit. And countries including Turkey and South Africa may also be no-shows. But about 90 countries have confirmed they will attend. I think there are about 75 heads of state involved. For the U.S., Vice President Kamala Harris is slated to be there, but Biden is not. Swiss officials say the participants hope to set a course toward lasting peace in Ukraine, to reach a, quote, common understanding about ways to achieve that, and to come up with a roadmap aimed to get both sides involved in talks. Now, that's not a roadmap to peace, a roadmap aimed to get both sides involved in talks at some point. But the meeting may focus not so much on specific proposals for peace, such as those put forward by Ukraine and by China, which are obviously quite different, as on three key issues that are related to Russia's war on Ukraine. That's the safety of nuclear power plants in Ukraine, including the massive Zaporizhzhia plant, which is held by Russia, food security, including freedom of navigation in the Black Sea, a crucial route for Ukrainian grain exports, and the return of captives, including Ukrainian children who've been taken to Russia. Their unlawful transfer is what's behind International Criminal Court arrest warrant for Putin on war crimes charges. Olga, how important do you see this peace summit as being? And what are the chances that it could substantially affect the course of the war?
So this is the latest, and I think the initial vision for it was that it was going to be the greatest in a series of meetings as part of a Ukrainian diplomatic initiative to get more countries of the world on its side. It's kind of a truism that you don't negotiate with your friends, you negotiate with your enemies, but that's not quite true, right? You negotiate positions with your friends, and then you go and you negotiate an end to the shooting with your enemies. And what Ukraine is trying to do is widen the people, the countries with which it is negotiating positions, trying to kind of co-opt and bring it, not in a normative sense, right, but it's trying to bring in a lot of countries that agree with the basics, the international law of the fact that it was invaded, that Russia is claiming its territory, that, you know, all stealing children, it's basing military, it's put a military base on top of a nuclear power plant, all of these things. So this is the idea. Now, Russia has run its own diplomatic effort to keep countries from participating. And that has had some success. And I think to some extent in asking for a summit and asking for something really, really big, Kyiv may have gotten a bit over its skis, not because there isn't support for Ukraine, but because the senior-most leaders, they need to get something out of this. So showing up at the meeting just to show support, some are willing to do it, but a lot aren't going to come to a meeting where everybody's going to come away from this having affirmed much the same things that they've affirmed before, which is all you're going to get without the Russians there, right? So this isn't a conversation about ending the war. It's a conversation about Ukraine being in the right. Switzerland has sought to make this at least the groundwork for something that could later involve Russia. And, you know, I think they've done their best to both temper expectations and to kind of broaden the conversation. But it's tough, right? These issues that are on the agenda are certainly not new issues. We know what they are. And it's hard to see much more than affirmation of positions coming out of this. So to answer your questions, it's important insofar as it's about Ukrainian diplomacy. It is about what continues to be a really widespread global recognition that Ukraine is in the right. But I'll be very surprised if it in any way affects the war, at least in this at this stage. We'll also see what happens afterwards. You know, is the idea, will there be more meetings, and will they be summits, or will they just be conferences, or will they be something else? Who will show up? I think that will be important. If it fizzles out from here, then I think it will be a failure of Ukraine's diplomatic initiative. But I think neither Switzerland nor Ukraine would like to see that happen.
Okay, I'm just going to follow up, I guess, with a question about the United States, the U.S. involvement. With President Biden will be, we've had the G7 summit, which is in Italy, southern Italy, but still bordering Switzerland. But he's not scheduled, at least, to go to this the Swiss peace summit. Vice President Harris will be there, and Jake Sullivan, who is obviously heavily involved in policy in Ukraine. I mean, is that a sign that the U.S. is sort of hedging its bets, or you know, wants to avoid, I don't know, having Biden involved if it is sort of ends up being not very effective?
It's a sign that the United States does not think anything is going to come out of this meeting.
Okay, thanks. And I guess just one other question about China. China, you know, obviously, you mentioned that it's an attempt. This will show these countries that attend that, you know, essentially they see Ukraine as being in the right. I mean, do you think it's a surprise that countries like China are not attending? I mean, China obviously, you know, is obviously sort of backing Russia in the war, you know, to some extent. Would it be sort of an entirely different ball game if China were to attend, or is this some sort of, do you think the organizers pretty much expect? I mean, Zelensky was criticizing China, saying it should attend and accusing it, in fact, of undermining the goals. But do you think Do you think it's a big deal that China's not attending, or is that sort of to be expected?
Look, I think the Chinese, they attended one of these meetings. They clearly did not find it that useful to their goals and interests. I think they pushed hard that if you're going to have one of these meetings, it needs to involve both the Russians and the Ukrainians, which of course was a no-go. And it, you know, so Beijing has made the decision that it doesn't want to be associated with this endeavor, at least at this time. You know, it is also a way of showing that it remains a supporter of Moscow, though I don't know that anybody was particularly doubting that. But I think if they had chosen to attend, particularly at a very senior level, the Ukrainians would have painted it as a sign of a break between China and Russia. So I think that's also probably a factor. But you know, I think the Chinese have made it very clear that they would like to see diplomacy go forward in a different way, in a way that isn't about as much about everybody pressuring Moscow and more about something else. Right. I mean, if you look at their peace plan, it's not really a peace plan, nor is the Ukrainian one. So yeah, there's lots of peace plans floating around that aren't really peace plans. But you know, their vision is one that at least on the surface looks more like mediation and less like unconditional surrender, which of course from the Ukrainian standpoint looks a little bit like surrender. So that's why they're not particularly interested.
Okay, I see. And sorry, I'm just going to follow up with one more question. Russia has been, in my view, doing quite a bit to sort of paint Ukraine as the recalcitrant side, the side that does not want, is not ready for peace talks. All this recent, talk about the Istanbul discussions that happened early in the full-scale invasion. Do you think this Swiss summit can do anything to kind of combat that, I guess that claim and sort of, advance the idea that Ukraine is, seeking, wants the war to end. Russia, despite Putin's repeated statements that he's essentially ready for talks or ready for peace, again on Russia's terms with the so-called new realities. But do you think this can sort of, I don't know, change that dynamic in any way?
They are willing to have talks as long as it's the other party offering a surrender, right? I mean, that's both of their conditions for talks are effectively the other side accepting defeat. So, you know, maybe the Russians have gotten the rhetoric a little bit better in saying, you know, they started with "we're totally willing to talk to them," and then they explain once they surrender. And the Ukrainians say, "We won't talk to," basically, the Ukrainians say, "We won't talk to them until they recognize." So it's they're saying mirror image things, right? But the Russians have framed it as "we're ready to talk," and the Ukrainians have framed it as "we're not." They both mean we are not willing to talk until the other side surrenders. And I think both Moscow and Ukraine have a theory of victory that amounts to "we will outlast you." Sooner or later, you will realize you can't keep doing this and you will be forced to offer concessions. So they kind of wait for the other side to do that. Now, part of Ukraine's model for how you do that is you convince everybody else to put pressure on Moscow. You make the Russians feel isolated. Thus far, that has failed.
All right, thanks very much. On that note, quite interesting comments, and we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks. Thank you very much for joining me, Dr. Olker.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
All right, great to talk to you. Once again, I've been speaking to Olga Olker, the Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the Crisis Group. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.referl.org.